Hello and bienvenue to Film Weekly and welcome to the Cannes Film Festival 2009.
We declare open the 62nd Cannes Festival.
C'est trop, merci, je demande au jury de nous rejoindre.
Oui, mes amis, the festival is officially underway. The closet is awash with the international film elite. I'm Jason Solomon, and it's my great pleasure to bring you the opening flavours of Cannes 2009. A little later on, I'll be joined by Guardian film critic Zan Brooks to discuss the opening night film, Up, Louis's Spring Fever, and to look forward to the treats in store over the next 13 days here on the closet, including premieres by Quentin Tarantino, Lars von Trier, and Pedro Almodovar, to name just a few. It's not just about Cannes this week. Back in the UK, Charlie Kaufman's directorial debut, Synecdoche, New York, goes on release, and I catch up with him to talk about his move from screenwriter to director. But first, we turn to a film by the British director Ken Loach, who has for over four decades established himself as a legend here in Cannes. This year, he's back in competition for the 10th time with Looking for Eric, a tragicomic depiction of Eric Bishop, the Mancunian postman who's in a life crisis and turns to his hero for help. His hero, of course, is his namesake, Eric. Eric Cantona. Earlier this week, I spoke to Ken Loach about his reputation here on the Croisette and his latest film, which explores those signature Loachian themes of fear, courage, and the working class hero. But first, let's hear a clip from Looking for Eric.
I suggest a jump of the nearest block of flats.
Well, it's all right for you, flawed genius bastard. Playing beach football, VIP, celebrity pals. You've even got a French accent. Eh? Look at me. You got it all, mate, all of it.
You think my friends are better than yours?
It's all just slipping through my fingers. The lads look through me. And I can't even trust myself. I feel like I'm floating and I'm looking down on myself, wandering around like a scabby old dog.
Ken, welcome to Film Weekly, a special Cannes edition of Film Weekly. I suppose Cannes must be something you hold very special in your heart. I mean, you're a winner here for The Wind That Shakes the Barley. They've always been very, very kind to you here on the Croisette.
Well, they've been. It's been a very nice audience so far, but we're just touching wood and crossing our fingers it'll be all right this time. But no, I've been very lucky because I went first to the Directors' Fortnight years and years ago. I think Kes went.
So you're saying you came with Kes in 1969. That is, my maths is terrible, but that's 40 years ago.
Something like that. I was in short trousers at the time, I think.
Can I ask what it was that about Cantona? Because I believe that he approached you first of all. So I'm trying to work out how this film came together, the film about, I suppose, a working class man's hero, an idol, but also an idol who's in touch with very much those impulses and very aware of the swell of the crowd.
Yes, Eric Cantona and a French producer called Pascal Cocheteau got in touch just to explore the possibility of making a film about Eric's relationship with the Manchester United fans. I mean, that was the starting point. And we talked around various ideas, and Paul Laverty is the writer I've worked with for the last 15 years. We talked around it, and then Paul really started with a blank sheet of paper, but with that as a brief. And the first thing was he wrote this character, Eric Bishop, another Eric, and whose life was in tatters, and whose room was a shrine to Eric Cantona. Mm-hmm. And that was really the starting point. And then Paul wrote a script, and we knocked it backwards and forwards, as we always do. But basically, Paul wrote the script, and we showed it to Eric Cantona, and he was very generous enough to say he thought it was okay.
And was he in the original script? I mean, did he appear as he appears? Yeah.
Yes, well, there wasn't an original. I mean, Paul's script was where it began, really.
Right, so Eric Cantona was always going to be part of this. Well, how did you find him as an actor? Because he's an extraordinary, I would call him a presence.
Well, very easy. I mean, he's done some acting now in France. He's had one or two big successes.
He's worked with André Téchiné, hasn't he, I think?
I believe so, yeah. He was terrific. I mean, he just turned up and did it and enjoyed it and was just one of the gang, really.
And is he a big Ken Loach fan? I would think he is.
Well, I don't know about that, but we found we got on very well, and he got on very well with everyone else. I mean, it was a very easy group, you know.
Your last film at Cannes, if I'm right, now it reminded me, Ken, is that was the one that was part of Chacun son cinéma, when all the previous Palme d'Or winners contributed a little segment. You did one about football then, didn't you? It was about a man and his little lad preferring to watch a football match than watching in the multiplex, wasn't it?
Exactly, yes. Well, we went through the list of films that were available, and they all sounded so awful. They thought they'd go and watch the game instead, which I must say is how I feel most of the time.
So now you've combined the two, really. So if anyone wanted to watch football, they could watch Looking for Eric, and they're getting a bit of cinema and quite a lot of football as well.
Indeed, yes. So well, if they didn't like the film, at least they can enjoy the goals, can't they?
Absolutely. Well, I've got to say that I really enjoyed both, Ken Loach, and it's always a pleasure to see you in Cannes and a film of yours in Cannes. It's sort of it's always part of Cannes. You know what I mean? That kind of look, the kind of English look that you and Barry Aykroyd, your cinematographer, always conjure up. It seems to be very much part of the fabric of a festival like this.
Well, that's very nice of you to say it. Hope other people agree.
Well, I'm sure they will. Can I just, because you're tirelessly, you're on the road again, aren't you? You're casting for your next film already.
Well, we just started, yes, to get our minds on the next one. Yeah, we're just scratching around and seeing what we'll do.
Right. Well, you never stop, Ken. I mean, forgive me if I'm probing, but you are over 70.
Well, you see, when you're in the second half, you've got to keep pedalling.
Second half, man. You're in extra time,
I would say. Oh, don't say that. No, the penalties.
Yeah, but if Ken Loach is in a penalty shootout, you know who's going to win, Ken. You're stuck in bottom corner every time. Best of luck. Another goal, I'm sure you scored on the Croisette this year. And congratulations. Félicitations on Looking for Eric for you, Ken. Thanks very much for joining us on Film Weekly.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
Well, in my opinion, Looking for Eric is one of Ken Loach's funniest films to date, and in great part this is due to its fabulous cast of actors, in particular the performance of Steve Evarts, who plays Eric Bishop. Ken Loach is famous for keeping his actors in the dark, so when I caught up with Steve, I first asked him if he knew if the great Eric Cantona would make an appearance in the film.
The scene in the film where I am talking to the poster of Eric...
Yeah.
Now, at that point, I had no idea that Eric was going to be in the film.
Yeah.
And we did about five or six takes of that. And then Ken got me out of the room on some pretext or other. And then we came back and he said, well, we'll do one more. And it was that they had Cantona upstairs. He'd got him down and they'd stuck him in a wardrobe. And I'm talking to the poster.
In a wardrobe? Yeah.
Well, yeah. And then this voice behind me saying, turn around, turn around. And I'm thinking, what the hell's going on here? And I turned round and 4 foot away from me, Eric Cantona stood there while the camera's still rolling.
So those reactions that we then see, Steve, are your absolutely bona fide kosher reaction to a surprise.
Oh, yeah. He'd done it a few times, Ken. It's an absolute wonderful way to
Because he does... It is a film that kind of... goes through many emotions, isn't it? It starts off kind of sad, but then it becomes really funny, and then it becomes surreal, and then it becomes funny again, and then it becomes a bit more serious, you know, a bit more social and realist.
Yeah, no, it's got everything in it. I think Ken surpassed himself with this one, but I would say that because I'm in it.
You're the star, mate.
Yeah, but it's not me being the star. It's the way the whole project was handled. Paul Laverty's script was fantastic. Mm. A good, strong cast in it. I'm just one of the team to the way Ken, watching Ken work, and he's putting 35 milli through the camera all the time. Yeah. He doesn't really rehearse a scene. He just starts filming it.
Yeah. Have you made any plans for Cannes? Because, you know, I don't want to build it up for you, but, I mean, I'm lucky enough to go every year. And I remember being there in 1998 when Peter Mullen was a kind of unknown, and he was in this brilliant Ken Loach film, My Name is Joe.
Yeah, My Name is Joe. I've seen it, yeah.
And he was a guy who worked in community theatre, and everyone was like, the whole place was like, who the hell's he? He's brilliant. You've never seen him before. And I've got a feeling, Steve, which is why I wanted to talk to you, because I've got a feeling that's going to happen to you.
Well, you know, first of all, you can't take anything for granted in this game. And I think what was more likely is going to happen to me is when we're going up the Croisette, people are going to be going, oh, there's Ken Loach who made Cares. There's Eric Cantona who played football. There's John Henshaw, the guy out of the post office. I went, who the fuck's that? And I'll probably have to blag my way into the Premier League. I'll probably get stopped by a bouncer saying, "Where's your pass?"
Yeah, well, don't forget your tie, because you do. Have you got a tuxedo? You need one, you know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's all in hand.
I'm right.
Gonna have to hire one.
Yeah,
it'll be odd, really, to have a suit on and not be in court. So that's That's a plus.
A huge thanks to Steve Evatt there, who's making his debut here in Cannes. It's going to be a big week for him. It reminds me of Peter Mullen in 1998 when he came out of nowhere to be in Ken Loach's My Name Is Joe in competition. He does stand a chance, I think, Steve Evatt, of a Best Actor award or something like that, but really the big prize is the Palme d'Or, and Zan Brooks is still with me here. We saw the opening film up. We mentioned it earlier at the top of the show. That was a cartoon, a risky business opening a festival with a cartoon, a 3D animation, putting us all in our 3D goggles. Did it pay off?
I think it paid off for me. I'm imagining it might not have paid off for you, Jason, because it's risky business for you personally as somebody who doesn't actually like cartoons.
I like The Jungle Book.
You don't like the modern day cartoons.
No, there are no songs.
But I did like this. You know, maybe it was a bit lightweight. Maybe it kind of lost its way a bit in the middle, I thought. The script got a bit soggy.
Yeah.
But it's a really sort of heartwarming poem of old age, really. And it's a sort of the sort of movie hero that you rarely get to see in the movies. This cantankerous 78-year-old man who's a widower and is mourning his wife. These aren't the sort of the natural ingredients for a summer blockbuster, which is what Up basically is.
Yeah, where's the Kung Fu Panda, I was thinking, in this. This is a Disney Pixar creation, much like the winner of Los Angeles Film Critics Circle Best Film last year, Wall-E. You know, the critics are loving cartoons at the moment. Looking at Todd McCarthy, normally kind of irascible variety critic, and Mike Goodridge from Screen International, they've given this film raves, like it's the best cartoon ever made. That shows the Cannes hyperbole in action already.
I think it does. I think that Pixar have hit upon a kind of magical formula, and they are churning these out, and they are reliably winsome. They absolutely do the business. They completely kind of pull you in. My slight problem with them, I guess, and it's becoming a growing problem as I see more and more of them, is that they're almost a bit too fine-tuned. They know exactly what they're doing, and they kind of hit all the right buttons, but they're maybe, for me, losing that element of surprise a little bit.
Yeah, they're very clean, I think, which is what you would do with that animation, because every frame is studied and worked on. And I thought emotionally they're getting clean as well. John Lasseter, he pushes those buttons that you mentioned. For me, they're always about home and simple pleasures, and I think there's a little quote from the boy who's the friend of this kind of irascible old man, is that it's the boring things in life that you remember most. And they're always about, like, well, just forget adventure. What's really nice is a nice cup of tea at home with your kids, which is a nice thing to think about here in Cannes. And I even cried a bit in this film behind those 3D goggles, especially when it was about old age in the first half. But I'm just a little bit like, can cartoon really contain all that's in the human heart and all that's in life?
Well, I think it can. I think, you know, we shouldn't write off cartoons for that. But you're right that the form actually weirdly limits it. Because you're having to kind of painstakingly assemble these films over a long period of time, it squeezes the sort of the chaos out of it and the loose ends and the kind of weird little pockets of ambiguity. All of those are kind of neatly swept away. So you've got a pitch-perfect, genuinely moving at times film that nonetheless you don't really carry much away from.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's about soaring with the house carried by balloons, and that goes up, and I didn't feel down from it, but I didn't feel as kind of elated as I think most people did here on the Quizette, and that made me feel like a curmudgeon, I have to say. But then, hey, why shouldn't I feel a curmudgeon? I'm away from home, and, you know, that's what John Lasseter's films are about. I should be at home. That's what I'm thinking. On another front, we've seen another competition films now. We've just sort of really come fresh from it. Liu Ye's Chinese director, who was here a couple of years ago, caused a great scandal when his film Summer Palace played without playing to the censors first in China, and we thought, brilliant, let's get a reaction from all those Chinese people. They'd gone overnight, vanished, called back home. His next film is called Spring Fever. It's in competition here, and I imagine that the Chinese censors haven't seen this one too.
Well, this is a sort of fascinating story, really. I mean, Liu Ye came here 3 years ago with Summer Palace, which was basically a little bit like Bertolucci's The Dreamers, and it was showing how kind of sex can be a revolutionary act, and it was sort of cast against the backdrop of Tiananmen Square, so obviously this was not going to play well to the Chinese authorities. Liu Ye was, after that, promptly banned for 5 years from making films in China. So the fact that he somehow got around that, he's really doing him himself no favours with the powers that be with this, which was shot slightly under the radar. I'm sure China has no idea that this film has been made, but here it is in competition. You know, this is a film about homosexual relationships in modern-day China that begins with a fairly explicit sex scene and ends with another fairly explicit sex scene.
There's quite a lot of sex in it.
There's quite a lot of sex. But there's also a terrible kind of tragic unfolding. I think Liu Ye is great at showing the winding down of people's lives and the chaos that emotional upheaval causes to people. You know, most Hollywood movies paint them as revelatory, wonderful affairs, but Liu Ye basically paints them as pretty disastrous for all concerned.
Perhaps informed by the politics that kind of obtain in China, because there was a lot of shaky camera work. He felt very enclosed by this, and the claustrophobia necessitated by the secrecy of this relationship. It wasn't the newest approach to sort of homosexual love I've seen on the camera. I mean, it's often about the clandestineness that can kill it. But I thought it did seep out rather beautifully, and we got a kind of snapshot of China coming in at the edges, the kind of shopping malls, the street markets, the kind of workplaces of people. And I thought that was rather fascinating. It's a film that's sort of staying with me. I mean, I've only just seen it, but the music I thought was rather brilliant, and each scene seemed to bleed into another. I think technically it was a very kind of assured and kind of new-looking kind of piece of cinema.
It had a lot of kind of new wavy sort of tricks in it. I mean, it's sort of handheld digital video, basically taking us through the karaoke clubs and the cramped apartments of modern day China, and a few jump cuts in there too. So yes, it did have a sort of a freshness and a life about it, I think. I think at times it's a bit opaque. It's certainly it's not an easy watch. It's going to kind of put people off. You know, it's the total antithesis of the Pixar film in that very little is explicitly explained here, and it's all dark pockets, this film. Yeah. And there's one key scene where there's a kind of rapprochement between two of the main characters, which Liu Ye elects to kind of shoot through this kind of gauzy curtain, so you can't actually see what they're doing in there anyway. And, you know, this is... So he's really holding the audience at an arm's length, but at the same time, absolutely bewitching them. And you're right, I think this film is a film that kind of seeps into your skin a bit.
Yeah, if the I think it was very interesting programming, having the opening and then this one, and this film, the first one was up, and this one I think was a bit down. Zan, that's what happened in the competition already. Let's just throw forward slightly to what's upcoming, because we have to record this show, obviously, before the real competition gets completely underway. What are you looking forward to over the next couple of days and week?
I'm looking forward to seeing the Lars von Trier film, Antichrist, if only because... from the trailer, it looks like a kind of dodgy horror movie. And yet this is Lars von Trier, so he can't be making a dodgy horror movie, unless he's making a movie about dodgy horror movies, right, and a kind of game on the audience.
Well, really, his dodgy musical, Dancer in the Dark, won the Palme d'Or here, and I loved it.
Did you love that? I didn't love it.
I don't know. I've never seen it again. I don't want to see it again. I loved it for that 2 hours that I saw it.
Yeah, I didn't. I thought it had great bits to it, but I really didn't. But the thing with Lars von Trier is he's never boring. Mm. I mean, even if he makes a bad film, it's still a fascinatingly bad film.
I mean, I've hated the one since Dogville and Mandalay, that non-trilogy.
You see, I love Dogville. I thought Dogville was absolutely superb. Mandalay was just doing the same trick again, and I couldn't see the point of that. And God forbid he should do a third one, as he's promising to do. But he is here, even though he's terrified of flying. I think he's driven down
he
through
comes in
Europe.
A camper van.
He comes in a camper van and presumably parks on the Croisette somewhere. And...
That's so Danish.
Yes, it's so kind of, you know, hippie, isn't it?
All that free love. You're looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to the Tarantino Inglourious Basterds, just because it's the Tarantino. It's very long, though, 2 hours and 42 minutes. I mean, that's quite indulgent. I'm worried that it is overindulgent. I mean, his last film played in competition here, Death Proof, God knows how it got in competition. It was a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, I think so. They love him here. I mean, you know, it was Cannes that really sort of set him in the pantheon when he won the Palme d'Or back in 1994 for Pulp Fiction. He was jury president here a couple of years ago. So he is a real darling of the Croisette. And like Lars von Trier, he's always sort of guaranteed to kind of whip up a bit of a storm. Again, Inglourious Basterds looks ropey from the trailer, and even sort of self-consciously ropey again. He's really going for the sort of spaghetti western Nazi horror movie about Jewish soldiers sort of rampaging across Europe.
Oh, one of those.
Scalping Germans. I mean, presumably this is all totally historic on historical record here. So it's obviously going to be a World War II movie based on the World War II movies that he's seen, you know, things like Cross of Iron and things like that.
Which I loved.
Yeah, and Tarantino makes great films about films, and that is basically what he does. Yeah. So yeah, I'm always interested to see a Tarantino film.
What about the there's kind of a high female quotient this year. We've got Andrea Arnold's Fish Tank and Jane Campion's Bright Star, both kind of British-ish movies showing in competition here. I'm quite looking forward to seeing what those developing talents kind of do. Jane Campion's obviously been here many times before, but Andrea Arnold, who was here with Red Road, she's here with Fish Tank, and I think that could be a very interesting piece.
I think so. Red Road was came out of nowhere to win a prize 3 years ago, and this is Andrea Arnold's second film, and it's the second British film after Ken Loach that is in competition, so this is really good. I'm noticing as well that the Brits are trying to claim the Jane Campion Bright Star film as a British film as well, because it's got British money in it.
Yeah, the UK Film Council.
UK Film Council. How do we judge these things? Jane Campion is not a British director.
She went to art school in Britain.
Did she? But, you know.
Ben
Whishaw is British. But it's
John Keats. It's about John Keats. He's British.
Even so, surely it's the nationality of the director. If you're going to do some sort of citizenship test on films, nationality of the director.
Yeah. Well,
it's not a British film.
No, they do that here in Canada a lot. It's down as a New Zealand film, because this is the World Cup of film, so it is a kind of nation's battle. Any surprises you're looking forward to in the comedy? I mean, I know there's a lot of auteurs kind of lined up here, heavyweight auteurs, Smackdown, it was described as by Variety. But there are still some surprises in there, some unknown quantities, a bit like the Lumiere that we're talking about. You're never quite sure what you're going to get. Anyone you're looking forward to being surprised by?
Well, I'm interested to see the Marco Bellocchio film. Now, Marco Bellocchio isn't an unknown new gun. He's actually been around for like 40-odd years. But he made like one of the great film debuts ever, I think, called Fists in the Pocket back in the mid-1960s, which I remember seeing a couple of years ago and being absolutely blown away by. And so far as I know, he's never kind of equaled that.
Yeah.
But he's back in competition this year with a film called Vincere about Mussolini's first wife. So I think in the current climate with the kind of Berlusconi regime, maybe having a few little parallels with the dark days of Italian history, I think that could be an interesting film.
Yeah. And Italian cinema is on a big up because of last year, Gomorra and Il Divo played in the competition and sort of really put it back on the map as a kind of vital kind of place in world cinema. I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to the Jacques Audiard film, Un Prophète. He's made some of my favourite films, A Self-Made Hero, Read My Lips, and more recently, The Beat My Heart Skip. So I think he's kind of mainstream art house kind of thriller maker. He seems to me like a French Scorsese. I think he's got that sort of talent in him.
Yeah, and this has the potential to be this year's Gomorra from the sounds of it. I think it's about a Corsican growing up in the projects, kind of falling into a life of crime. And you're right, Odiar is a very talented director who hasn't quite been hailed in the way that he should be.
Yeah.
And so maybe this is the film that will kind of set him right up there among the greats.
Absolutely. And can the French again do a double, having not won the Palme d'Or for 27 years or something? They won it last year with The Class. Could they repeat that and win it again? Zan, you'll come back at the end of the festival and we'll round those up and find out if we predicted well or badly or if we were surprised at all. It'll be a great pleasure to see you then, won't it?
At the moment, it's like being a kid at Christmas, isn't it? Where all the presents sort of lined up under the tree and you're kind of looking at the thing and the wrapping's looking great. You know, that one's going to be great. That one's going to be great. And we've still got to kind of open them and find out.
Zan, I can't wait to see your face when you do open the biggest surprise of your life here at Cannes 2009. Thanks for joining me. Go off and go and do some red carpet action.
I shall try. The security guys will bundle me out of the way.
And don't forget to follow Zan Brooks' coverage of Cannes 2009 on The Guardian's dedicated Cannes website at www.guardian.co.uk/film. You're listening to Film Weekly's first Cannes special, coming to you from the Croisette here at Cannes 2009. I'm on a balcony looking over the Croisette and over those famous red steps which are about to disgorge all the famous clientele who are assembled here for the opening night of Cannes 2009. But cast your minds back, because this time last year, at last year's Cannes Festival, one of the most memorable and divisive films was the directing debut of Charlie Kaufman, Synecdoche, New York, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman as a theatre director who sets about creating an alternate life in the form of a giant-sized theatre set of Manhattan. Kaufman is one of the most innovative screenwriters working today. Being John Malkovich, Adaptation and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind have structurally and visually pushed mainstream cinema in new directions, and Synecdoche, New York is no different. However, where his previous work as a screenwriter have brought him overwhelming critical acclaim, now, in the director's chair, Kaufman has had to deal with terrible reviews and awful box office in the United States. It was with this in mind that I went to meet him at the Barbican in London to find out more about Synecdoche, New York, and how instructive the change from writer to director had been for Charlie Kaufman. But before I speak to him, let's hear a clip from the film with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Samantha Morton.
Did you put something in it?
If that's what it takes, consider it done. Poof. Love potion number 69.
It's good.
Does it make you want to kiss me?
Kind of.
Tell me why.
Because I feel a lot of longing.
Beg a girl. Why don't you?
Please, Hazel.
On your knees.
What?
I want you to beg me on your knees for a kiss. Just for fun.
Why am I doing this?
For fun, baby.
Charlie Kaufman, how wonderful to see you and welcome to Film Weekly. I must say you're one of the guests I've been most anticipating on Film Weekly, mainly because I saw your film Synecdoche, New York, 12 months ago. It's a whole year since I saw it. I saw it at the Cannes Film Festival. And I have to say it's a film that's lived with me ever since. I've seen it again since, obviously. I still can't work out if it's brilliant, if it's bonkers, if it's both. But it's seeped into my soul. It seems to be an entirely kind of new way of telling in film, a kind of new genre. Did you set out to make something this new, or is it this just the way that your visual mind works?
I set out to tell a story honestly, that it was reflecting how I felt about things. So, and maybe when you don't set out to create a product, maybe that looks different than a conventional movie.
It's interesting you say you tell a film a story honestly, because the film, it seems to me, is about the impossibility of telling stories honestly or creating art that honestly reflects life.
Well, I think that that's part of being honest about it, right? Is to include that in the limitations of storytelling, or in this case, trying to organize this character, trying to organize his life into a story, and that there is a limit to how you can do that. That I think that always sort of enters into my work, that, you know, whatever it is that I'm exploring, then I have to step one step back and explore what it is that I'm exploring, and then explore what it is that I'm exploring that I'm exploring. You know, I think part of that might be my OCD type of brain chemistry, that I do that.
You were always going to be directing it?
Well, originally Spike was going to direct it when it was at Sony,
Spike Jones.
And then when he was going to do Where the Wild Things Are, and he wanted to do this movie afterwards, which would have been like 5 years later, I said, can I do it? And he very nicely agreed to let me, and then Sony put it in turnaround. And I was interested in seeing what it would be like to direct something that I'd written, and I'm interested in working with actors. And
yeah.
So it was kind of, you know, something that was time for me to do, I thought.
It's a different ball game, isn't it? I mean, you're sitting, you're writing, it's all in your head, you can kind of have some control. When you get on set, like Philip Seymour Hoffman in your film, like Mr. Cotard, getting these things right is difficult, I should imagine.
Well, it's different. Getting it right is hard, but also you're dealing with a very, very pragmatic kind of job description, which you're not when you're writing. I liked it. I mean, I wish I had more money and more time, but I like the sort of managerial aspect of it, and the social aspect of it, and the working with actors aspect of it, and the working with a production designer and trying to figure out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very much.
Because I mean, there's some fantastic visions in your film. That the actual vision of the warehouse where we get to, and the kind of endless stretching kind of vistas that you imagine for your signed New York. Did you come? Is that CGI? Did you build set? How
it's
did you actually technically?
Both, but you know, we did a lot of computer stuff. Because you can't build New York City in a warehouse, you know.
It's kind of an impossible movie, which I really like about it.
I like it too, and I like the fact that we did it for a price, and you know, and that yeah, we could have done this movie easily for $150 million, and you know, but we didn't.
Yeah.
And that required a lot of really creative people to work really hard.
Mm. I don't know if I can see you. Not, this is not to do you out of that big payday in Hollywood, but that 150 million script, you and Jerry Bruckheimer, you're kind of getting down together and you want to make a kind of surrealist take on, I don't know, Pearl Harbor or something. Like, can you work with that kind of budget?
Nobody would give me that kind of money. I don't think anyone at this point would give
you like
that.
You looked at me like I was mad for suggesting.
Well, no, I mean, that's like right now, because of the way this movie performed in the U.S., no one would give me the money I had to make this movie.
Was there a sense when you were making this that you knew it wasn't mainstream, as we've discussed there, and that someone had given you, let's say, whatever it was, the budget, $20 million, $21 million, then, and you were going to direct, was there a sense that you know that, you know, this is going to be difficult, a difficult sell, it's going to be kind of hard for audiences maybe to flock to, some are going to love it, some are going to hate it. This was your big chance that you might, as you say, never be given this budget, this money again?
I didn't think about it that much. I think that the success, which was moderate for those other movies, for Eternal Sunshine and Adaptation and Being John Malkovich, was also surprising. I kind of was thinking it's possible that there'll be enough interest in this to sort of justify the budget. I wasn't thinking, oh, this movie isn't going to make any money.
But you're not as perverse as one might level at you. You were actually sort of quite almost bucking the system from within.
No, and in fact, you know, somebody said to me once, some guy I know, you know what I loved about your movie is like you just said fuck you to everybody, you know, fuck you to the people who gave you the money. And it's like, no, I didn't. I mean, that's not my motivation for anything. And I would not, if I didn't think that this movie was gonna make the people the money back that they spent on it, I would not make it. I mean, I didn't know, but I didn't go in thinking, yeah, I'm gonna steal these people's money. No, I would. I mean, I'm not that guy, you know. I think I did a really good job in delivering the movie that they thought I was going to make. Mm-hmm. That's based. I mean, I delivered the script made into a movie. They weren't. They couldn't have been surprised.
Right. The rest of your films and your writing seem to kind of look at life and find it surreal, but find the humor in it.
There's humor in this movie. I mean, this movie is a comedy, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. And depending on what audience you watch it with, it gets a lot of laughs. And sometimes I've heard laughs in this movie up till the very last moment, including. I'm not going to say what the last moment is, but you know what it is. Yeah. People laugh at that. Yeah. And then people argue online, like, how could you laugh at that? You're heartless. You know, this suffering is like, it's a comedy, you know? I mean, if you don't laugh at it, that's fine with me. I mean, I want people to be affected by it, how they're affected by it. But it's also fine if you do laugh at it.
But you like laughing. I mean, you like the Marx Brothers.
I love laughing, and not only do I love laughing, but I love when people laugh at things that I say. So, I mean, it's very important to me, and so certainly I'm not averse to people laughing at things that I write.
Charlie Kaufman there, and Synecdoche, New York goes on UK wide release from Friday the 15th of May. Well, that's it for this first edition of Film Weekly from Cannes. The music you've been hearing on this show was from the brilliant Synecdoche, New York soundtrack, written and composed by John Bryan, who you may know as a producer of the likes of Rufus Wainwright and Kanye West, but he's also a brilliant scorer for the big screen and done Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind for Charlie Kaufman, as well as things like I Heart Huckabees. My thanks to all my guests on the first Film Weekly, to Ken Loach, to Steve Evett, and to Charlie Kaufman, and of course to Zan Brooks. Do pick up a copy of this week's Observer newspaper, where you can read my Cannes reviews and of course the legendary trailer trash from Cannes. Next week we'll have another Can Bonanza for you, but for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer back in London, Jason Phipps, it's au revoir.